Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're off! Ah, we're doing it. And just like on cue, as soon as we begin, there's Nathaniel with mug in hand, taking a drink, actually on when the shit hits the fan, he's incapacitated himself with a hot drink.
I'm freewheeling. I'm like Chris Moyles, or one of them people. Freewheeling radio person.
If only you were Helm and Moylesy, hey? Imagine. Sure. Doesn't matter. Anyway, so you're listening to Fan Club. This is what day is it? It's Friday the 20th. Is it?
Will it be? It'll be about then, won't it?
About then.
It'll be this 19th.
Friday the 19th. Unlucky for some. That's what they say, isn't it? Remember, Friday the 19th of February.
What's your name?
My name's Nick Helm. What's your name?
Nathaniel Metcalf, pleased to meet you.
And the catchphrase across the nation that everyone shouts out as soon as they hear it's Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf, and the nation in respond go, who? That's the little thing. It's like nice. It's very much our nice to see you. To see you nice, isn't it?
It's the first rule of Fan Club, Nick.
Tell your friends about Fan Club. I think if you've got any, then why
keep it to yourself?
Why not? Why keep it to yourself? But also, that's my microphone. If you've got any friends, why waste your time listening to a radio show or podcast? Why not do a Zoom call with them?
I suppose you can do that, yeah. You can. That's about all you can do in these.
Not long now, hey? Do you think that? What do you think? Another?
I don't know. I don't like to think. I'm trying not to get ahead of myself.
I think another 2 weeks and then I'll be out there shaking hands with everyone. Remember this time last year, I'm not worried about.
I remember
being out there shaking hands with everybody. There
was that couple, wasn't there, who were on like a cruise or something, and there was this big reveal at one point that they had corona, and it was a big shock. And then you realise, oh, everyone's going to get it. They were the first people in the UK to get it, and then at the time it felt like such a big deal, and now everyone's had it now, aren't they? Well, they haven't had it. That's the problem.
So I'm just thinking that not this time a year ago. When was it? 6th of March. 6th of March last year I went to see Supergrass. At Alexandra Palace. About this time last year I went to see Ramesh Ranganathan at Alexandra Palace. He very kindly he asked me to come and see him because he was cooking up a new show, and he respected my feedback enough. He said, can you come and see my new show? And I said, oh yeah, sure thing, Rom, anything for you. And he gave me one ticket. So I had to sit and watch him by myself.
Respected your opinion, but not your ability to have any friends.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like, well, who am I going to tell, Rom? Little did I know it was a taste of things to come. A whole year of solitude. And so I did that like probably late February, and then I think a week later I went to see Supergrass at the same place, where all these strangers were coming up to me and hugging me and breathing on me. People were just like, when I went to see Ramesh, despite the fact that I was in a sitcom with him, no one recognized me. I was left very much to myself. I got there. It's kind of like a good news, bad news thing. kind of, you know, you go, oh, good, no one's recognised me. And then you go, but why? And then it's like, is absolutely no one watching this sitcom that we've done? This was like my, this was my chance at the mainstream, being in a Ramesh Ranganathan sitcom.
Surely this is where the people that are fans of the show will be.
Yeah.
This is where to find them.
No, and I spent, so I was on my own. I got a drink, watched the first half in the interval. I queued up, I got myself another drink. Like nothing, no one, you know, you're milling around for half an hour, waiting for the show to start back up. And then I sit in my seat and I'm surrounded by, this isn't a comment on Rom, but I'm surrounded by empty seats. I'm just like going, well, I could have brought someone easily. It wouldn't
have.
Yeah. And I had a seat enough for me to put a bag next to me, you know. And then, and just as the lights are going down, there's like four kids in front of me. And one of them turns around and he looks at me and then he nudges his friends and they all point at me and they go, Lemon. Because that was my character in Rom Show. They go, Lemon! And I just say, not now. And then the lights went down and then Ramesh came out. And that was that. And then I went to Supergrass the next week, and it turns out that Ramesh's audience and the Supergrass audience, I think the people that watch Uncle are all very much ex-Britpop fans.
Right, yeah, it makes sense.
And fucking hell, my friend Rebecca, who is a cook, she said it was like being in a zoo enclosure. Like everyone was just sort of like staring and pointing. It was horrible. It was literally horrible. And yeah, people were coming up to me and grabbing me and kissing me and getting their photo taken with me. And it was like, but it was like I was with people and I was just being dragged around. At one point, I went to the bar after the gig and the whole side of the bar were all sort of like staring and pointing at me. And they're all on their phones because what happens is people start Googling you because no one exactly knows who you are. So they Google you and they go, it's that guy. And then they're like, oh, it's that guy. And then they'll start pointing.
Google Man from Uncle and get lots of pictures of Robert Vaughan on there and go, it's not him.
It's not Henry Cavill either. Yeah, so and then that night I got home and I got really ill. And then I think I was ill for 2 weeks.
Yeah, yeah. I forget how quickly we started doing these Zoom ones. Because we were doing it a few weeks. I remember my birthday is at the end of April, April 29th. And on my birthday last year, we did the Bob Saget episode, which was a few into the... a few runaways. A year of Zooms.
So Friday the 6th was the day I got ill. I was ill for exactly 2 weeks. And then I think it was Friday the 20th that we went into the first lockdown.
Yeah.
So just as I felt well again, that's when we went to lockdown. So when's your birthday?
April 29th. Apparently the first lockdown episode was 10th of April.
Yeah, and that would
be... We've been keeping the nation entertained for almost a year over Zoom.
So that would be with Bilal, right?
Yeah, probably was that one, right?
I think and since then, not saying that we're responsible, but since then, Bilal has absolutely fucking exploded. I met Bilal. I'd met him a couple of times, I think, but not like to any profound degree. I met him at the Leicester Comedy Festival, which was this weekend, wasn't it? So normally over Valentine's weekend. I remember because in 2010, I did He Makes You Look Fat. For the very first time on Valentine's Day, and I made a woman cry. There was 9 people in the audience, and one of them was crying. And they were like, oh, no, that's more than 10%. This isn't good. So I thought I'd never sing it again. So Valentine's Day, the festival goes over, like, mid-February. So I met Bilal like then, and then we got on really well, so I brought him onto the show. And he's done amazing. He's one of the few people that's really profited profited from Corona.
Yeah, him and Amazon. Him and Jeff Bezos are the two kind of people who've done well out of Amazon.
Really made Corona swing in their favour. So good for them. Bad for us. Yeah, good for them. And now a year on, and here we are. So thanks everyone for listening, I guess. We've had some ups and downs. This isn't a retrospective one. What have you been watching this week, Nathaniel?
See a film that I was going to talk about. I was going to talk about the film Brain Dead, not the Peter Jackson Brain Dead. It's like a Roger Corman produced Brain Dead with the two Bills, Paxton and Pullman, from 1990. Have you seen this?
Paxton and Pullman. Bill Paxton and Bill Pullman. Oh, right, OK. No, I haven't. There's the two Bills, and then there's the unofficial third Bill.
Campbell?
William Sadler.
William Sadler, right, yeah.
Yeah, that's who I was thinking, because he did Trespass with Paxton, didn't he? There's William Sadler, Bill Paxton, Ice-T and Ice-Cube. Both the Bills, both the Ices, Trespass. It's a roller coaster.
Oh, it's a great movie, Trespass. Braindead's pretty good.
Braindead. So who directed Braindead?
Can't remember the name. I think he's called Adam. Is he called Adam Shires or Adam? He did a lot of documentary stuff. He did the Carnosaur stuff for Corman, but he's obviously he's very much in the Joe Dante mode. He's very kind of influenced by lots of old sort of B movies and 60s movies. And that the film itself is very, very much like that. It feels like a Joe Dante movie or something. Mm. It's people doing brain experiments and Bill Pullman ending up kind of on a journey inside his own brain in kind of, it's filmed in this quite wacky, over-the-top, turned-up, bright-coloured way. But almost because it's this sort of weird, sort of paranoid film as well with Bill Pullman, the film it kept reminding me of is Lost Highway. Adam Simon is the director.
Yeah.
So it's got, and it's just nice that in my head, it's quite nice to go, oh, it's Paxman and Pullman. And that felt like a bit of a draw.
Oh, right. That's the one with the face stretched over the.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that.
Right. Okay. I think I remember. See, there are these films that were in video shop covers, video shop windows, and they gave me nightmares. And I think maybe Brain Dead was one of those films. I think Nightbreed was maybe another.
Hmm. It feels like the most horrific kind of horror on the cover, and yet it's basically a comedy. You know, it's also Bud Cort from Harold and Maude.
Harold and Maude, yeah. Wasn't Bud Cort also in the original Bates Motel Psycho spin-off TV series?
He might well have been, yeah, that makes sense.
I think he owned the Bates Motel, and it was kind of like there's a new adventure every week. Sorry, that was just an absolute... Oh, I think that's like nerdy. That's nerdy top trumps, isn't it? That's literally...
Yeah, I like that. It impressed me.
But what else was Bud Cort in? Bud Cort was in something where...
He's in... More recently, he's in Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou.
Not that. He's in something where he just looks... Because, I mean, you remember him from...
Harold and Maude as his child.
Yeah, and then the majority of other things you see him in, he's like this bald kind of... It's not Coyote Ugly. Oh, well, I guess we'll never know, Natalie.
Dogma?
No, it's not Dogma. We just have a list of everything rather than... Why don't you just copy and paste an entire list of everything that he'd done rather than one at a time trying to guess?
I think maybe he as well. Apparently a lot of the cast in it are... people from Tim Robbins's theatre group. Hmm. So it's got a lot of those guys popping up. It's got the guy from Tenacious D, who's not Jack Black and things, popping up for just playing very kind of character parts in it. And it's a real, like, fun movie for something that's very throwaway kind of Roger Corman film as well. Yeah. But it does both things. It's sort of better than that, and also is exactly that thing.
I think Roger Corman made quite a lot of really good films. Aside from the classy ones that he did with Vincent Price, I think after that, I think they're really good. What's that one that I watched? The one about the sea monster from beneath the... That one. It was great. I think I watched that about a year ago today. Secret Diary of Sigmund Freud, no. Telephone, no. Bates Motel, there you go. Leather Steak, Out of the Dark, Going Under. Okay. Creature from the Haunted Sea. It wasn't that. It wasn't that at all. So
it's a good way of knowing that if you're working in Hollywood, there are all these tons of character actors who've been in loads of films. So why don't you kind of make your supporting cast just those character actors? So everyone's popping up and you're like, oh yeah, it's him. And it makes for a richer kind of film, I think, to watch.
What film is this again that you're talking about?
Braindead.
That is on the list of films. Where did you see it?
I got it on Blu-ray. I was sort of reading a thing about it and it came out, I think it just came out just before Christmas. And I got it in a kind of, oh yeah, that intrigues me actually. I haven't seen that.
In the UK?
Yeah, in the UK. And the director Adam Simon had done this. He made a documentary about Sam Fuller that I remember from when I was a teenager that was on Channel 4. And he made that then. And then I was also just watching a lot of Sam Fuller films as well over Christmas, and that made me kind of intrigued about his other films. And
so who's Sam Fuller?
He kind of made lots of kind of B-movies, but for studios, kind of quite cheap, but very, very kind of hard-bitten kind of crime movies often that kind of sort of push the envelope a bit. But he's like, he's one of those directors who, you'll know him if you saw him, he's kind of like this old guy, always has like a big cigar, makes kind of quite hard-bitten films. I'm trying to think what his most... He did, like, in the later years, he did The Big Red One.
Is that with Mark Hamill?
Mark Hamill. He did Underworld USA. He did... what's it called? The Shock Corridor. He's done a bunch of stuff. But often they're not obvious kind of films. But they, when I was after watching that documentary, I noticed that on Channel 4 at the time, lots of his films used to be on all of the time. So you could watch. They were always on in the afternoons and things. These old movies. Pick Up in South Street, 40 Guns. And they're always like either kind of... He basically went from being a newspaper man to being a... in the Second World War, and then he started making movies. So all his films tend to be like war films or based on like crime, almost like very like pulpy crime stuff, tabloidy crime stories that you'd get from like American newspapers. He's like a newspaper man.
Brad Fuller.
Sam Fuller.
Okay. Well, I'll give it all a go. I'll give everything a go.
Hello. What have you been a fan of this week, Nick?
Well, speaking of the Joe Dante stuff, so Christopher Plummer died.
Yes.
And I can't really... It's so weird. Like, I haven't seen a lot of Christopher Plummer films, I have to admit. But I think he's had a real impact in my life. I do absolutely remember so clearly that Sound of Music was one of the first three films that I saw at a cinema. And it's such a... And I've got a niece, and they've been... and I've seen my niece about twice in her entire life. And my parents were showing her little bits from Sound of Music.
You should probably say that your niece is actually very young, and that's why you've only seen that.
Oh, yeah, she was. Well, she's just over 1 year old. I got to see her just before lockdown, and then I've seen her in real life maybe 3 or 4 times, but that's it, really. I've seen her online, but she just cries every time. So I'm waiting for her to get to about 3 when she doesn't cry all the time. But I'm sure as soon as you're allowed to see people in real life, I'll see her as much as I can. But my parents lived down the road from her, and they showed her like the puppet show from Sound of Music and stuff like that, and like she was absolutely transfixed by it. And I don't know how much TV my sister lets her watch. I've got a feeling it's not that much. So maybe it's just a moving image that's kind of like captivating. But Sound of Music is famous for being this very light, almost twee. The reputation it has is this twee film about singing nuns and teaching kids how to sing. But it's an amazing film about music opening your heart, and it's such a complicated film in terms of like emotion, like the emotions it deals with, you know, when you realize that the girl's boyfriend, who she's in love with, is basically a Nazi. You know, you're kind of, as a kid, you find all of these conflicting emotions that you can't quite understand. You feel betrayed, you feel sad, you feel disappointed, you feel like it's wrong. It's just like, so it's not really a kid's film, although I suspect a lot of kids grow up watching it. It's a very complicated film in terms of emotions, you need all of that twee, light, frothy. And the songs are incredible, but you need all of that first half of the film, because when the second half kicks in, and you know, you feel the Nazis kind of like approaching and taking over Austria. It's such an incredible film. When I was watching it, you could draw quite a few parallels to Inglourious Basterds to it, you know. And even later on, when you see Hateful Eight, and he's put an intermission in Hateful Eight. I know that when they made Oklahoma, there's kind of like an overture at the beginning, because Oklahoma was the first screen musical. So when they didn't really know how to make a film out of it. So when...
Oh, that thing, like a stage musical, you mean?
Yeah, it was just kind of like, how'd you do that? So then what they did was they tried to make it as much like a stage musical as possible. So, and you see that in stuff like Singing in the Rain, where there's like these huge dance routines. They've got a sound stage, and then Gene Kelly has kind of like orchestrated this this dance routine over this huge stage, and they just film it as live, almost in like as few shots as possible to let the dancing do the talking, as if it was on stage. And and I guess that's what they did with Oklahoma, where they're kind of like letting the musical do the talking for it. They go, well, it's a musical, it works perfectly. So it's going to be about 3 hours long, and there's going to be an orchestra at the beginning and an interval in the middle. And the Sound of Music's very similar in that respect, where you have like this intermission halfway through. And the second half, I don't think, is as strong. Weirdly, watching it as an adult, I probably haven't, because I'm so familiar with the film and I've grown up with it, I think you feel like you don't really need to revisit it, you know? Because it's kind of like, yeah, I remember that. But when you actually sit down and watch it and you actually realise, you know, the complexities of it, it's... So the first half is just, like, absolutely solid. And then you have this interval. And we actually paused the film and then did something else for a couple of hours, then came back and watched the rest in the evening. And the second half is kind of like much more tense, and it deals with like heartache, and it's a little bit more melancholy. And Maria grows up, and she falls in love with the captain, and you know, and Julie Andrews is absolutely just phenomenal in it, and Christopher Plummer is this amazing kind of like counterpoint, and he is so good in that film. And so when I was talking about when I tweeted, you know, I'm going to watch some Christopher Plummer films, it's weird because like The Sound of Music is such an important film to me. I always list it as one of the, it comes up quite a lot because it's just like, it's like one of my earliest memories. Mm-hmm. And obviously I am obsessed with films and I love films, and so it comes up all the time in terms of like earliest memories, my relationship with my dad, and also kind of my relationship with cinema and what I think is, and it's got such a horrible reputation as being this thing that Hindus dress up in fancy dress and shout at the screen. Do you know what I mean? Mm. It's kind of like, it is that, but it's almost like, it's almost like considered in the same breath as something like Mamma Mia, Joe.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, it's not, it's like this actually really sophisticated, complicated film that needs the lightness of that first half for the second half of it to work. And it needs there to be a film about nuns for the Nazis. You know, it's like nuns and Nazis, and then you've got Julie Andrews and Christopher Plummer that are kind of like counterpoints to each other. And the fact that Christopher Plummer is this broken-hearted captain that through music learns to connect with his kids after his wife dies, and through music he learns how to love again. It's just beautiful. It's a beautiful film. So it's in stuff like when you see 12 Monkeys and Christopher Plummer's in it, it's kind of like an oddity because you go, that's the guy from Sound of Music, and he's not anything like he is in Sound of Music. He's all old. And I remember when Up came out, and the Pixar movie Up, and I remember kind of after the opening 10 minutes, it's a film about talking dogs. So it's got to be something that keeps you entertained. And one of the things was like Christopher Plummer plays the bad guy in Up. And so whenever he's mentioned in anything, I've always been interested, but I've never spent that much time kind of going through it. So when I said, I'm going to watch some Christopher Plummer films, you and some other people recommended some Christopher Plummer films. So I sat down and I watched them all. And I sort of like this very sort of uneven, frustrating career. Because Sound of Music was his breakout hit. He'd done a few films before that, but Sound of Music was like his breakout hit. And I think he really resisted doing it. And he's like, he's in The Man Who Would Be King. And he's very much kind of like, if he'd wanted it or if he'd have aimed for it, he could have been kind of like a Sean Connery or a Michael Caine.
Mm.
But he was never regarded in those respects. And I read an interview where he said he's not interested in being a superstar. He's just interested in being like a character actor and finding the parts. But what that led to was he was very often second on the bill playing the bad guy. And so you see stuff like, what was the one that you recommended? Mindscape.
Silent Partner, I think I recommended.
But there's that Joe Dante thing that you said, and it's you said it's like Joe Dante. It was Mindscape, the one with Dennis Quaid.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Where they go into dreams, and you see that second on the bill or third on the bill playing like this horrible government shit. He's good at it, but it's kind of like a sort of a generic role that's heightened by him. Mm-hmm. I rewatched Dragnet. I grew up hating Dragnet. Just nothing in it for me. Really unimpressed by it. I just find it deeply unfunny. For a comedy, it's kind of, you know, unacceptable. But Christopher Plummer's in it, and he's playing this very sort of like camp kind of villain. In a way that you wouldn't really expect from him, because he's so sort of like serious in everything else that he does. And so you're kind of like, go on.
I was going to say, it's funny, last week when you were talking about him being in Star Trek VI, because the day after he died on the BBC, one of the people they had interviewed was William Shatner, who grew up with him, and they were kind of sort of contemporaries in the theatre in Canada. And William Shatner saw him as like, he's the guy, you know, he's the one everyone wants to be.
Well, there's this really weird, because they started off doing radio together. And if not together, they were in sort of like the same rolling cast of people that did Canadian radio. And it's just really, it's really interesting because like Christopher Plummer was playing Henry V and Christopher Plummer got taken ill and William Shatner was his understudy and William Shatner came in and Christopher Plummer's got this, there's a clip, you can find it online, it's Christopher Plummer talking about William Shatner. And Chris Plummer was just like saying that he upstaged him every turn because whenever Christopher Plummer stood up to make a speech, William Shatner did it sat down. And whenever Christopher Plummer raised his voice, William Shatner whispered. Do you know what I mean? So he just did the opposite of what Christopher Plummer did, and he kind of like stole the show. I just think that he's so good in Star Trek VI. Star Trek VI is... I mean, I've just really watched all the Star Wars films. I love Star Wars. I love how operatic it is. I love how mythical it is. I love that it's a fantasy. It's a fantasy more than a science fiction. But I'm coming to terms with the fact that I really like 2.5 Star Wars films. Whereas with Star Trek, it is science fiction. It's not fantasy. It's not, you know, it's not a space opera. It's classic science fiction. And I like about 4 or 5 or 6 of those films. Oh. And like a lot. Probably never, none of them individually as much as I like the Star Wars films that I like. But they're great. And Star Trek VI is probably, I think it's better than Wrath of Khan. And it's definitely better than Star Trek IV with the whales in it, but I love Star Trek IV with the whales in it because it's nostalgic to me. It's what I grew up watching. It's time for a song, but I think we could probably still talk about it. We've got Christopher Plummer films in common that we should talk about, so let's talk about that after the song.
Yeah.
Tom and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
Okay, we are back. Although I'm back on my own, Nick is still indisposed while we've been listening to our Alice Cooper song, which I also missed because I was also indisposed for the last 2 minutes. We've got a to catch you up on some of the things we've been talking about. One of our Bill Pullman facts we've been given is that Bill Pullman is a big fan of exotic fruits and makes his own jams, pies, and baked goods. He also loves to freeze fruit. I don't know why you would freeze fruit. He's an admirer of beekeepers, so he makes his own preserves. Do you ever freeze fruit, Nick? We're rejoined by Nick Helm.
Oh, what's happened?
I was just telling him about Bill Pullman's facts that he is a fan of exotic fruits and makes his own jams, pies, and baked goods. I used to work opposite a fruit.
Do I freeze my own fruit?
I don't know. I've never done it. It seems like a weird thing to do to me.
You haven't lived?
I used to work opposite a fruit and veg stall, and they had a sign on that said, with bananas and exotic fruits. And I always wondered what an exotic fruit would be, or whether a banana would be considered exotic fruit.
I think a banana is exotic fruit, but it is commonplace now, isn't it? So,
apparently, Bill Pullman's favourite food-related film of all time is Babette's Feast.
That's a great film.
Have you got a favourite food-related film, Nick?
I watched a lot of films about food for when I was doing Eat Your Heart Out.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was that. But me and Johnny Sweet, when we were making Loaded, we talked about food, films that had food in them. So there's films like Last Night, Big Night, which is the Stanley Tucci film. Tucci. That's an interesting film about food. Is it Tom Popo?
Oh, yeah, Tam Popo. I've never seen it.
Tam Popo. That's my friend Rebecca's favourite film. I think Johnny Sweet really loves it. And there's Eat, Drink, Man, Woman. So I've got... I can't remember if he bought them for me or I bought them based on his recommendations, but they're films that kind of like I haven't
found in Parasite when they were cooking that kind of noodle dish, always thinking, what is that?
I just remember from The Host when they're eating the ramen noodles in... Well, they're in the back of a van and they boil a kettle and they're all eating these ramen noodles. And I just remember whenever I get like a tub of ramen noodles, I follow the instructions, you know. You pour the water up to the line, you let it stand for 3 minutes and then you kind of give it a stir. But in The Host, they've got their chopsticks and they're just like slamming away at the noodles, trying to get them to sort of like break up as quickly as possible. I think that's... So I remember stuff like that. Also, like, obviously, the scene where they're making food in Goodfellas in prison.
Yes, I think of that as well.
It's so descriptive. And there was that Mel and Sue TV show, Late Lunch. Hmm. Or I think it was Light Lunch and Late Lunch.
Yeah.
It changed time slots. I think Johnny Vaughan was the guest. And he came on and he kind of like, the lunch that he made was based on the recipes that you get from Godfather. Like, you're watching The Godfather and then halfway through the film, they just stop all the action and then one guy teaches another guy how to make meatballs. And it's kind of, I love like moments like that in films. Mm. So I think, food is quite a cinematic thing. Also like the stew that they're eating at the beginning of The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, where Angel Eyes comes in and helps himself to stew, and they basically have this Mexican standoff while they're eating stew. And I just find that you always want to know what they're eating now.
Yeah, I do. And I guess it's that thing where you're always going to feel hungry if you're watching something and they start cooking on screen. Start going, it both takes you out of the story but really kind of sucks you in. You get another kind of bit of... another sense.
Yeah.
It's element to it.
Exactly what I was just about to say. It's like when you're watching Goodfellas, you see them, and not that I'm sort of like obsessed with gangster films, but I think it's a good example where you can see them... you're watching them, and it's not like just this film where there are these thugs going around doing stuff. You kind of like get to know a little bit about kind of who they are through the food. And when they give you the recipe, you realise that the men are doing the cooking as well. It's a family thing. And then you also can picture the tastes and the smells that are going on in that kitchen while those scenes are playing out. I think that's great. Babette's Feast is an absolutely phenomenal film. So I give that a thumbs up.
Before I ask Cooper, we were chatting about Christopher Plummer.
So the Christopher Plummer film is called Brainscape, not Mindscape. But so based on your recommendations, I went. I watched this thing. So Dragnet, I hate, but he is. He's not just the best thing in it. I would say he's the only good thing in it. I think he's just hands down fantastic in it. But I knew about that growing up. There's this film called Eyewitness with William Hurt and Sigourney Weaver. That's like a marginal thriller that he's in a little bit. I think it was both of their second films, someone was saying, or after their breakthrough films. What was that? Altered States and Alien. And then they came together and they made this film. Christopher Plummer's in it. But again, he plays like a generic sort of like bad guy, villain guy. And so you're kind of like, after The Sound of Music, searching through all of these films, kind of like going, I know later on in life he was used as sort of like a generic, not generic, but he was like the go-to guy. He's not Sean Connery. He's not Michael Caine. He's this old character actor that's about the same age that's being used in a lot of mainstream films. You know, David Fincher uses him, Terry Gilliam, you know, he's in all of these films. And he won an Oscar in 2010 for that Ewan McGregor film. So he's kind of like, but why is Christopher Plummer famous? It can't just be The Sound of Music. And then you watch these films, he's just so consistently good. I remember him as well as the Duke of Wellington, but I haven't rewatched that from Waterloo. And then, based on your recommendation, I watched Murder by Decree, where he plays Sherlock Holmes versus Jack the Ripper. Was that your recommendation?
I certainly like that film, so I may have done, or it might have been on that list of someone else's. I may well have recommended it, though. It's very good. I guess Sherlock Holmes is a good one because it's also a character part, isn't it? It's a lead part, but it's also a very actory thing to play.
Well, you do what you can with it. I mean, what's interesting is I did a podcast last week with Josh Widdicombe, and he was saying one of his favourite things is Sherlock Holmes. I love Sherlock Holmes. My girlfriend loves Sherlock Holmes, which I found out this week. Because Murder by Decree and The Silent Partner were both... So Christopher Plummer was Canadian. So there was a Canadian film company that made a bunch of films with Christopher Plummer, Donald Sutherland. They were kind of like these Agatha Christie kind of thrillers that they made. And there's this Canadian-British production company that were making all these films. And so they're not really available in England. So I had to get Murder by Decree and The Silent Partner on Blu-ray. And when they arrived, it's the same production company. They've got the same trailers for each film.
Oh, right, OK, yeah. I would like to have got The Silent Partner. I've only ever seen that. The cinema things.
I feel sort of protective for Christopher Plummer, because I feel like he deserved more. He deserved almost superstar status. And when I learned that the director of Porky's directed Murder by Decree, and it was, oh, it's a Sherlock Holmes film starring Christopher Plummer as Sherlock Holmes, but it's directed by the guy that did Porky's. I was assuming it would be sort of like quite an exploitative, low-rent take on Sherlock Holmes. But you watch it, and it's just this classic. It's got an amazing cast. It's got David Hemmings in it as sort of like this side character who could have played Watson, really. Mm-hmm. And then you've got James Mason. It's like almost like the perfect Holmes and Watson. It's Christopher Plummer. I always said that Alan Rickman would have played like an absolutely phenomenal Sherlock Holmes. And the thing is, you know, I find Sherlock Holmes stories really comforting. I find that era really comforting. So I've never really gelled to the Benedict Cumberbatch, Robert Downey Jr. stuff, because it's kind of like everything that I love about Sherlock Holmes is kind of like thrown out. So I love the pacing, and I love the fact that it is quaint and old-fashioned. So when Guy Ritchie comes along and he modernises it all, you go, no, that's not what I want from Sherlock Holmes. I don't want to see him as like this bare-fist-fighting sleuth that's working. Do you know what I mean? I don't need sort of like Matrix angles and all of that stuff in it. And then when you see Benedict Cumberbatch in the modern era, it's kind of like part of the selling point is the fact that it's Victorian, you know, for me. So when you go back and you know, I love all the Basil Rathbone films. So it's kind of like when you watch Christopher Plummer do it, you know, Sherlock Holmes has the tendency of being quite a very cold character. And last week on Amazon, there's a... Who's Patrick McNee as Watson and Christopher Lee as Holmes, and they're like older Holmes and Watson, and there's some really funny stuff in that. That's on Amazon Prime, and I guess it was two feature length, part one and part two episodes of sort of a pilot TV series that never happened.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know the origin of it. I think it's. Yeah, I think they're filmed somewhere like Prague, aren't they, somewhere, I think.
They look like, yeah, I was going to say Paris or something, but they look very European, and they're very TV. They're very, like, 90s TV. But it's Christopher Lee as Sherlock Holmes and Patrick McNee as Watson, and there's some funny jokes in there, and it's kind of good, but like Holmes is always like this very sort of like cold, sort of impenetrable character, right? And when you watch Murder by Decree, it's so good. And Christopher Plummer is unmistakably Sherlock Holmes, but at the same time, he is of just this very warm and compassionate character. And also, when James Mason signed on to it, he was like, I don't want to be the bumbling Watson. I don't want to be like the comic relief. And he sort of still is, but it's just this very warm relationship between them. You know, a lot of the time you kind of like wonder why they hang out. But in this, it's like you can tell that Sherlock Holmes absolutely loves Dr. Watson, you know. And they just have this absolutely fantastic relationship where Watson goes off and he does all of like the heavy lifting and all the footwork and has to kind of like do all the dangerous stuff where he's hanging around brothels asking questions. Where Sherlock Holmes, that's beneath him, and he can be left to do all the thinking. And it's kind of like it really sells that relationship. And Bob Clark did like this amazing job with it. And then I watched, I will let you speak, but then I watched The Silent Partner, ironically. which was made the year before.
Okay.
Murder by Decree. So Murder by Decree was 79. Silent Partner was 78. And Christopher Plummer is playing like a character that is absolutely... I watched this last night. It's absolutely phenomenal. So I've waded through all of these kind of like Christopher Plummer plays generic bad guy. He elevates the role, but he's like this generic bad guy in so many things. There's that Christopher Reeve time travel film as well, where the theme tune to that is used in Groundhog Day. It's the one that he learns how to play on the piano.
Okay.
And it's the theme tune to that Christopher Reeve time travel movie.
I'd like to see that again.
Which is kind of like, you go, oh, wow, that must be an in-joke, right? It's a classical piece of music.
Yeah.
It's a classical piece of music, but Bill Murray in a time travel movie is learning how to play the theme tune from a time travel movie. So I watched The Silent Partner. Christopher Plummer is so absolutely... It's not. He is a bad guy in it, but he's not a generic kind of heavy. He's the most terrifying kind of psychopathic serial killer kind of... It's as far away from Captain Von Trapp as you can get. It's like he's and from Sherlock Holmes, which was it's like a completely different character. It's a completely different performance. He disappears into his parts in a way that Sean Connery and Michael Caine don't. Right, he becomes that character. He became Sherlock Holmes. You're watching Murder by Decree. It's an incredible performance by him, but he disappears into that performance where you're actually just going, well, that's Sherlock Holmes. Again, with Silent Partner, he does the same. And then the year before Silent Partner, he did sandwiched in between a TV half-hour Sunday drama that he did of The Silver Blaze, which is a Sherlock Holmes story. So he played Sherlock Holmes on TV in 77 for a half hour. He played the serial killer, or the psychopath bank robber in Silent Partner. And then he went on to do Murder by Decree, where he finally, it was his life's ambition to play Sherlock Holmes, he finally got to do it in a feature film. And so what you'd think of is you'd think that the Silver Blaze was his one shot, as far as he knew, to play Sherlock Holmes. So you'd think of that as a warm-up for Murder by Decree, but you watch it, it's on YouTube, it's a completely different performance. He said that Sherlock Holmes would have been a drug addict, he'd have looked really ill, he'd have been gaunt, he'd have been thin. So you've got like, he looks twice as old as he does 2 years later in Murder by Decree. And he's just playing kind of like this very kind of sterile, austere kind of version of Sherlock Holmes, which is what he doesn't do in the later film. It's almost like he's done that. He's ticked, tick, done it that way. So when you see... I was thinking when I saw Murder by Decree, he's almost too good-looking to be Sherlock Holmes. And then when you see The Silver Blaze 2 years earlier, it's kind of, you know, oh, he looks... I mean, he's been made up to not... to sort of, like, you know, spoil the Hollywood good looks that he had. I just found... And then in between, he plays this character... In between two Sherlock Holmes performances, he plays this character that is so far away from that. Like, he was phenomenal. I still think that Sound of Music is the film that he'll be remembered by.
Sure, and always will be.
But that is because it was... He was the second lead, but not in a way where he was second fiddle. He was necessary to the plot. He has an absolutely full character arc, as full as the main character. He's got so much screen time in that film that you really get to revel in what he would have been as a matinee idol or a top biller. And then you've got to sift through all the other stuff to find performances as good as that or as iconic as that. And they are there. But
I think it goes to show that that's his thing then, right? It is like he does want to be a character actor and he's completely rejected the idea of being a star and having to play a version of himself all the time.
I guess he's sort of proven that. Mm. But I also feel like we've been denied that a bit because he's so good as Sherlock Holmes in that film and he's so good as that killer, that bank robber in... it's such a... objectionable, disgusting part. And he's so good in it. You know, there's stuff like the fact he's wearing, it's really subtle stuff, like he's wearing mascara and blusher. Yes. And his nails are really beautifully manicured. And
he's like a psychopath, isn't he? He's like a proper...
Absolute psychopath. I remember we were watching it. There's a bit when he has a semi-sex scene where he's in a sauna and this woman gets naked in front of him and he starts massaging her breasts. And I turned around to my girlfriend and I said, I said, Captain Von Trapp, or something like that, right? And then the very next second, he beats the shit out of her. And then we were like, both, you know, we had a laugh, and then we were like, jaws to the floor. Fucking hell, what the fuck is going on? Like, this is horrible character. Yeah, really, really, really crazy. What do you think?
I was going to say, well, the thing exactly that, really, I was going to talk about, like, that he is kind of like the ultimate character actor in that way, because he's proven it. He has been a star, and he's, like, chosen against doing that.
Mm.
I was also going to mention that Bob Clark is the guy who directed Murder by Decree. He did Black Christmas, didn't he?
Yeah.
And Christmas Story. So he's done these kind of almost like very iconic films just through nature of being, I guess, a bit of a journeyman director. I think he's Canadian, isn't he?
Yeah, I think he is. Christmas Story is like this huge, iconic American Christmas movie, which got repeated over and over again on TV and became like a... But it's not as well known over here. But it's like the ultimate Christmas movie. And then he made Black Christmas, which is like the opposite, which is... That almost got banned because all the posters had Santa Claus with an axe on it and kids were having nightmares. And then he made Porky's, which was like the precursor. It's like sub-Animal House, but the precursor to stuff like American Pie. And then he made this really classy Victorian set, James Mason starring movie about Sherlock Holmes, which was great. At the end of his life, he was working with Howard Stern on a remake of Porky's. You mean Bob Clark, not Christopher Plummer, I'm assuming. But sure. He's great, and I think he's good in everything that I've seen him in. I think it's worth... I still haven't finished, you know. I've never seen The Man Who Would Be King, so that's next on my list. And The Fall of the Roman Empire, that's on my list. So I'm sort of like working through stuff. But it's great. We should do some fan mail and then bring our guest on, right?
We should.
Are you happy with that, Nathaniel?
I'm happy. I'm having some computer issues, but I'm with you.
I can see. It is a combination of me being overexcited and Nathaniel not really listening to what I'm saying. And me just...
It's a problem. I'm having a problem.
For the listeners at home, I don't know when to shut up, but also... Nathaniel isn't really in the room anyway. So here we go.
Yeah, back in the room.
Brian, can you take it? Okay, we can carry on. Brian, can you take it? Dear Nick and Nat, I recently watched The Bling Empire on Netflix. Have you watched it? I loved it. It's all about the lives of these billionaire Asian expats living in LA. So glam. Have you noticed that Netflix is releasing more and more reality TV shows? What's your opinion about that? Cheers, Marge. No.
I haven't seen it. I've noticed, I think Netflix are trying to kind of mop up everything, aren't they? They're trying, I noticed they had a thing on their front page today that's like a kind of, that looks like a kind of British ITV drama, kind of crime drama. And I think they're just trying to get every angle so that they've got something that, you know, my mum and dad would watch or whatever now. And it just makes sense because they're trying to cover all bases and be a proper channel, right?
I think in terms of like everything, Netflix is still the best. Right, I think I really like Amazon Prime, but the layout is fucking terrible, and it's just impossible to just scroll and find what you really want. Like, if you watch half of something, it takes ages to actually find the second, do you know what I mean, to pick up where you left off. I think the design for Amazon Prime needs to be sorted out. Netflix has got design and it's got content, although the content is weak. I do not see the point in Disney Plus other than if you want to see The Mandalorian.
But I think that's the selling point, right? They've just got enough things that you will... Like, I know I'll just eventually get it because there's now just things on it I want to watch, but there's not... I don't know if there's a lot of other stuff on it I want to watch. Well, for me, Netflix is kind of the worst one.
Netflix?
Yeah, I find very little that I want to watch on there. It's full of things that all just feel a bit like, I guess I could watch that, but nothing excites me.
Yeah, no, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I agree. And also, if you know, we're looking for Christopher Plummer films, you type in Christopher Plummer and then and it's got very, like, limited search. Oh, you know, Kevin Costner. And it's kind of like, you've got three Kevin Costner films, okay, right. So it's kind of like when you're... I just think the layout is really sort of like straightforward and easy to... No, is it, though? I just think it's all just a clusterfuck. Just simplify it, guys. It's like using the BFI website sometimes, am I right?
I heard Quentin Tarantino interviewed recently, and he was talking about Netflix. So this is Netflix in the States, where they actually have more movies on it. And apparently he met the guy who's like the head of Netflix and was complaining to him about it, going... You don't even have any films from the 70s on there. You've got hardly any. He said, after Burt Reynolds died, I just really wanted to watch a Burt Reynolds film. So I typed in Burt Reynolds in the search bar, and there was three Burt Reynolds films. And he said, and two of those were The Longest Yard. Exactly. And I think that's right. It's that kind of... Unless you like very contemporary films or a certain type of thing, it doesn't really work, because you won't
get... Well, straight to Netflix films.
Yeah.
But in terms of watching classic films, you still have to buy American Blu-rays and get a multi-region Blu-ray player. If you've got time for another, we've got one really short one. Hey, Nick and Nat, how are you doing? I can't wait for this pandemic to be over so that I can travel again. If you could travel anywhere right now, where would you go? Thanks, Matt. I would go to the South Bank and I'd go to the BFI and watch a film.
That's what I was going to say.
Is it really? That's all I want.
I'm not bothered about going anywhere. I just want to be able to do the normal things I used to do.
I just want to go and watch a film in Screen One at the BFI, and that's all I want, really. Right, let's play a song and bring our guest in.
Okay.
As I walk through the valley where I harvest my grain, I take a look at my wife and realize she's very plain. But that's just perfect for an Amish like me. You know I shun fancy things like electricity. At 4:30 in the morning, I'm milking cows. Jebediah feeds the chickens and Jacob plows. Fool, and I've been milking and plowing so long that even Ezekiel thinks that my mind is gone. I'm a man of the land, I'm into discipline. Got a Bible in my hand and a beard on my chin. But if I finish all of my chores and you finish thine, then tonight we're gonna party like it's 1699. We've been spending most of our lives living in an Amish paradise. A churn butter once or twice, living in an Amish paradise. It's hard work and sacrifice, living in an Amish paradise. We sell quilts at discount price, living in an Amish paradise. We've been spending most of our lives living in an Amish paradise. We're all crazy Mennonites living in an Amish paradise. There's no cops or traffic lights living in an Amish paradise. But you'd probably think it bites living in an Amish paradise.
And Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we are back. We're back live. We're not live. We're pre-recorded. We're in the studio. We're not in the studio. I'm in my spare room and Nat's in his washroom. My name is Nick. This is Nat. And we are joined by stand-up comedian, writer and Silent Hill enthusiast, Mike Drucker. Hello. How are you doing?
Hello. I'm good. Thank you guys for having me.
Where are you right now?
I am in New York City, in Manhattan.
Oh, do you know what? We've spoken to a few Americans, and I don't think we've had anyone live from New York.
Yep, yep. So I'm the first. I'm the first. Yeah. As you can see, my beautiful view. Lovely.
Our friend Pat Bircher is a Canadian, and he's just moved to Manhattan. He's a comedian. Do you know him?
I don't, but it's like the past year I haven't been able to go out and meet comedians. My entire social circle's been cut off.
He has. Well, I think he moved in last week, so. You probably don't know him. I'm not sure how many gigs he's done yet, but it's fine. It's fine. You've got very beautiful glasses, by the way.
Thank you very much. These are my trying to look presentable glasses.
Absolutely great. For the listeners at home, they're light blue.
Brown glasses, yeah.
And round glasses. They're very nice. Cool. Great. So you've written a book about Silent Hill.
That's right. Right. Silent Hill 2. It's part of the series called Boss Fight Books. Mm-hmm. I'm actually the 27th book in the series, so it's been going on for a little while. They're individual little books, like 100, 150 pages each that, you know, break down, analyze a video game, look at how it works, look at how it's made. And I chose Silent Hill 2 because I'm a big fan of it.
And I thought you as a comedian, when I saw you'd done it, I was like, what? I was kind of thinking, what is this? Is this sort of an arch take on? What is the, are you going to read it? And it's just weird sort of takedown of it, or it's very clever, and you go, oh, that's very clever. It's almost like a sort of an analysis, which is actually poking fun at it somehow.
Exactly. It's more serious, but it's actually like, it's what I went to grad school for literature. So it's almost the one time I've used my degree for anything in my life.
Yeah, I would say I'm not. I vaguely know about Silent Hill, mm-hmm. but I'm not a massive kind of video game person. I think it's probably the same, right? But I would say our audience, knowing the kind of people that listen to this show, probably the kind of, I imagine what they are, they're all blokes and they're all just playing video games all day. So I reckon that's who listens to this, I reckon.
We've just spent an hour talking about The Sound of Music, so I think that our listeners are desperate to be talking about Silent Hill 2 right now. All I know about Silent Hill really is that at the time it felt like there was Resident Evil, mm-hmm. and that was like a horror computer game, which kind of made you feel like you were there.
Yeah.
And then Silent Hill felt like, oh, right, well, that worked. Let's do something else. And then they made kind of a film with mm-hmm. Sean Bean in it. And then
kind of a film.
That's not inaccurate. It is kind of a film.
With Sean Bean in it, and actually, weirdly, despite the fact that I've never played them, I've never seen the film. During lockdown, I have watched a 45-minute analysis on the character Pyramid Head.
I've probably seen that too.
And I watched all of the design processes that they went through in order to get to that design. And I don't know why I watched it, but I watched the whole. It's been a long year.
Yeah.
So tell us about how you got into Silent Hill and all of this stuff.
I've always been into video games.
I just point out that was the worst question I've ever asked. Can you tell us about how you got into Silent Hill and all of this stuff?
And I was like, I'm going to try to do it. I'm going to try, I guess, as a child, I liked games, and I kept playing those games, and... I was in high school, me and my friends were super into video games, and Silent Hill was, like, the first games to truly scare me. Like, you know, Resident Evil is very, like, you have guns and you're blasting through things, and Silent Hill is a little more claustrophobic. Like, you'll still have weapons, but it's less you're a super soldier blasting through something, and it's more like you're a normal guy who's going through hell. And to me, that was very compelling, because I never felt like, I never connected to, like, you know, super soldiers. I connect to losers. And so Silent Hill 2 was the sequel to that, and it has such a good story, and it's such like a, for the time especially, 2001, it's such a mature story in a video game, and it touches on so many issues, and it holds up so well today, that I've just thought about it for 20 years. So when I got the chance to write about it, I took it.
So is it sort of like a puzzle solving game?
It's sort of like puzzle solving. It's sort of like you're walking around an abandoned town. You know, you fight monsters, but really most of that's optional. You can run from them, so the combat's not a big part of the experience. But yeah, you're walking around a town, you're solving puzzles, you're kind of trying to figure out what happened. You play this guy, James Sunderland, who showed up to... he received a letter from his wife, who's been dead for a few years, that says, like, come back to this town where we went on vacation together, which is the town of Silent Hill. And so he shows up, and the whole game is him trying to figure out, is his wife dead? Is his wife alive? Why did she ask him to come back? And it's a very sad story.
Oh, so I grew up playing Monkey Island.
Yes, totally different. The exact opposite of Monkey Island.
So it's like a sad, scary Monkey Island where where getting anywhere is optional.
If you love the fun of Monkey Island, you don't. Silent Hill 2 might still not be for you.
At during Silent Hill 2, does anyone jump on a mushroom?
Nobody jumps on a mushroom, which is my main criticism in the book.
It should be. But why Silent Hill 2 and not Silent Hill? I think that was the main thing that made me think it must be a parody. I was like, it could be a parody.
It's the first two games, they take place in the same town, but they have very different stories and they sort of function very differently. And to me, 2 is the better overall experience. So, I know it's everything about it. It should be a comedy book and it's not.
I think over here, Richard Iowadi kind of has written a book about an analysis of a film that's kind of a film he doesn't really like, but it's done in a way where it's a very kind of literate and...
Yeah.
And it's partly, it's a big... I sort of went, it's like that. It's going to be like that. Didn't you work for Nintendo?
I did. I worked for Nintendo for a couple of years in the localization department, which means I worked with Japanese translators to make things make sense in English. So idioms or accents or, you know, phrases or jokes or cultural references. Like a lot of stuff when you're translating, it's not just, you know, you're not just fixing the grammar. You're also like, all right, this character has a rough and tumble accent. What would we make that accent in English versus Japanese?
You know? Okay. Okay. That's part of the charm now of old video games that's gone, though. But you often quite something charming where you can sort of have this Japanese version of American English or whatever. It's quite a fun thing to hear. But I guess that's the whole point is to make it seem...
Yeah, to make it seem like it's supposed to be in English. Or in other languages. At Nintendo, we would translate it, we would localize it in English. Then we had a Latin American Spanish department and a French Canadian Spanish department, which would then send it to Europe for European Spanish, European French, and, you know, fucking UK English, because you had to add U's to everything.
I can see that. I can see the U's, but I would have thought we're so used to American culture that I'm sure we just basically got the American version of it and gone, this is...
Basically, yeah, but, you know, we'd work with Nintendo of Europe and, like, British writers would be like, hey, this phrase is not the phrase you want to use over here. And so we'd try to smooth things out to make it work on both coasts.
And this would be what year you're looking for Nintendo?
2010 to 2012.
So at this time, you're also performing stand-up?
Also performing stand-up, also touring. I wrote for a couple of award shows while I was at Nintendo. Yeah.
And what year did you start doing stand-up?
Yeah, so when did you start and why did you start doing stand-up?
I started doing stand-up in 2005 when I was in college. And I did it on a whim. A couple of people had told me I was funny. I thought, you know, it was one of those things where I was like, okay, I'll do almost like signing up for a gym where you're like, I'll go a couple times and then it'll be out of my system and I don't have to do this anymore. And I did an open mic and I liked it and I kept doing it. And over time I started to realize I was more of a writer than a performer. I like doing stand up, but I'm not an actor. I'm not a good actor. I've tried it. So I focused on writing and creating. And I started writing for places like The Onion and The New Yorker. And from that, you know, I started to pivot to TV. So while I was doing stand-up, I was also getting a lot of writing on. I was a freelancer for Saturday Night Live, so I got a lot of jokes on there. And it just turned into a career.
I saw, like, one of your early successes. You're in a stand-up competition, So You Think You're Funny.
Yeah,
We've got a competition in Edinburgh with the same name, but I imagine it's a completely different thing.
It's completely, yeah.
And it's something to do, which I couldn't work out, with Disney's Ratatouille or the Disney Ratatouille movie. Oh, so how can you do a stand-up competition, which is also about a Pixar movie?
So the movie Ratatouille stars Patton Oswalt and Janine Garofalo, which are both stand-ups.
Big fan of it.
And so their management company decided to have this competition around it, where they're to promote the movie. They're like, all right, so we'll have a stand-up competition for young amateur stand-ups, and the winners will get to perform with Janine Garofalo and Patton Oswalt. And I was one of the winners of that. And now that's also my management company, luckily. So that's how I got managed.
Okay, I can kind of, that kind of makes sense. As a marketing thing, it does seem strange. So you go, we've basically made this film about a rat in Paris who can cook. So what should we do to promote it? What can we do around that? And someone says, I don't know, a stand-up comedy competition?
Right.
They go, that sounds like absolutely nothing to do with the movie.
Right. Is it cheap to do? Yes. Great. Do it. Then do it.
But then I imagine that it's a way of promoting a kid's film about a talking chef mouse.
Yeah.
To a rat, I should say. sure. Otherwise it'd be called Mouse-a-tui, wouldn't it? the clue's in the title, Nick. It's a way of like promoting it to an audience that wouldn't necessarily... sorry, I'm thinking out loud now.
If you were a marketing person in 2007.
But it's sort of like, it's a way of letting grown-ups know that Patton Oswalt has made a kid's film.
Yeah, I think it's partially that. And it's partially like, you know, it was early social media, so I think they're like, how do we get people just posting about a thing when they still didn't know how social media worked? So I think it was part of that as well. If you pull the string on it, though, it's not a good idea. I'm glad they did it, but it's not a good idea.
Well, absolutely. You did very well out of it.
Yeah.
I did.
But also, you wouldn't imagine that you would have done well out of it. Because it's this thing where it would be the kind of thing where you go, well, what is this competition? Is it an established competition? It's a competition that Disney Pixar have created to promote the film about the a chef rat. It shouldn't have worked. I mean,
shouldn't have worked.
Power to you. I'm glad it's done very well for you, but it shouldn't.
I don't think it worked for anyone but me. I think I was the only one to benefit. They probably had fewer people go to the movie because of it.
Yeah, sure. I mean, they should have gone, do you want to be in a Pixar movie? Maybe that could have been the prize, right?
Ah, oh, that would have been such a great prize.
I did The British So You Think You're Funny.
What year were you in it then?
I was 2007.
Me too.
And at the end of the competition, I was the semi-finalist. What? So would we have been on stage together?
No.
At the end of the whole So You Think You're Funny process, I was never less sure whether I was funny or not. But you got management out of it, so you know, swings and roundabouts, isn't it?
Yeah. Although comedy competitions are death, no matter how long you do comedy.
And I imagine it's the same thing. I used to find competitions horrible because it's the one time when, despite what people seem to think about stand-up, certainly over here, is that I find a great deal of kind of camaraderie about it.
Yeah.
Competitions are the one bit where you really feel like everyone's kind of hoping you're going to die on your ass.
Yeah.
You're probably with friends who are kind of going, I hope you do really badly tonight. It's the one time that is somehow at the back of their mind.
Right. And when you do badly, it's them being like, all right, good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's a strange thing. And I don't think that's true any other time. I think there's a great deal of kind of camaraderie about stand-up, I always find, and everyone's kind of in it. And you're basically trying to create a good night.
Yeah.
You want everyone to have. And the person, I always think, if the person on before you does well, I always think it's going to make it easier for me because they're laughing.
Yeah, they're in a good mood. They're there for it.
They're enjoying themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would absolutely hate it when... I was on with a bunch of rubbish acts, and I would think, Muggins here has got to save the night. and night after night, that happened.
I was on that night, wasn't I?
Yeah, that's where we met. You remember, we met. So through stand-up, I mean, Saturday Night Live is obviously internationally renowned. How did you come about? What was the process of becoming a writer on Saturday Night Live?
Well, I was only a freelancer, so I want to be. Mm-hmm. I don't want to claim more than I was there. But that was like my first time getting anything on television, so that was significant. It was I interned for NBC, the, you know, company that makes SNL, for a while. And through that, I was able to meet Seth Meyers. And the thing about shows like that is, if you're young and you love comedy, they're really excited to, like, talk to you about comedy. Because a lot of younger people in college or after college who work at the show are very interested in celebrities. And there's a difference between celebrity and comedy. So, you know, a lot of people want to meet Lady Gaga, which is great. I wanted to write comedy. So they were very supportive of me, and Seth let me start submitting jokes to Weekend Update, Seth Meyers. And eventually I started to get some on. It took me maybe a year, but then I started to get more and more and more on. And from that, Seth hired me at award shows. And from that, I was recommended to be a full-on staff writer at Jimmy Fallon. So really, it was just loving comedy and sort of showing that I love comedy that got me in the door.
And is that the ultimate... So I know you're saying you haven't had a lot of time for stand-up, and I guess stand-up isn't happening, right?
Happening a little... Places are starting to open up. Like, my regular club just started taking avails again.
What's your regular club?
Eastville Comedy Club in Brooklyn.
Right.
It's just a fun... It's a fun club that, like, locals go to, which makes it... I don't... Like, do you guys ever play for tourists, and it's a little bit different than playing for, like, locals?
Yeah. Yes. They hate me.
Yeah, no, that's what I mean, though. That's what I mean.
Yeah, sure, right.
Yeah, yeah. Tourists from Sweden who wanted to see Dave Chappelle don't like me.
No, whereas when I play for, like, regular audiences, they really hate me.
I always think it's, especially over here, there's often lots of clubs around central London that when you get there, you go, oh, this is good, it's really busy. But it's full of people that they basically, it's tourists that they basically dragged into a comedy club.
Yeah.
What almost feels like a net or something.
Yep.
And they don't really want to be there. They want to have gone somewhere for the evening.
Yes.
And so they get to a comedy club. And often it's a thing where there's people who are from different places, and more power to them, and they're having a look around. But not a lot of them will even have English as a first language, maybe.
Yeah.
And they're watching a show. And they often look confused. And the reason they look confused is because often they don't really know what you're saying.
Yes.
and they feel like kind of bad. Place to go, right?
Yeah. But I'm sure, like, you know, you're in London or you're in New York, and, like, someone's like, hey, you're going to see a celeb. Because I don't know, like, in New York, they'll lie to tourists, and they'll be like, you'll see people from TV on the show tonight. And sometimes that happens, but sometimes it's someone who was on TV in, like, 1987.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah, we'd get these tourists who are clearly disappointed, or, like, you know, families who clearly this was their big trip to New York and they were so excited, and just them having to spend 3 hours bored.
And it feels like no one wants to be there. I don't want to be here.
Right. That's like, I've definitely on stage had moments where I've been like, to the audience, I've been like, I also feel how weird this is. Just so you know, I'm here too.
You know, I'd love for you to have a good time, but I don't think we're going to be able to achieve it.
Let's just ride this out.
So have you when I was in New York, when did I go to New York? About the time that I'm thinking was probably about 10 years ago. So we went to a bunch of comedy clubs, went to the Cellar. The one that I really remember that stood out was we went to Dangerfields. Now Dangerfields felt like a quite what's Dangerfields like?
It's a slightly older club, although I think they might have renovated it since then.
Sure.
But it had an older feel to it. There's like a couple clubs that felt, like, not old, like, terrible, but just, like, more traditional clubby.
No. Well, it felt sort of like, because when I started out working for a comedy club. I used to put the chairs out. And then I got to watch free comedy when I started out, when I first started. And there would be one show a night.
Yeah.
And then that's how it worked. What I remember about Dangerfields, there was an early show, there was a show, and then there was a late show. And the turnaround was literally one audience comes out and the next audience goes in. And while the last act is on, is that called the check spot?
Check spot. That's death, the check spot.
It's the worst, right? So in
it
England...
It is the worst.
in England, you're the headliner, right? And if you go on last, that means you're the best. But when I was in Dangerfields, it was just like, if you work hard enough, you get to go on last and compete with all of the waiting staff shouting over you, saying, like, hey, buddy, you owe us $125. And it's just kind of like, and then, because we sat in a whole group and we had to sort of like chat amongst ourselves and go, well, you owe 10 and you owe 15. And you're like working out how much you owe. And there's a guy on stage that's kind of like with his guitar, and you think,
oh,
you must have traveled on the subway with your guitar, man. That's terrible. And then as soon as he gets off stage, they're literally like, get the fuck out of here. We've got another show that's starting in 2 minutes. And it's kind of like this machine, isn't it?
It really is. A lot of clubs are like that in New York, yeah.
But then when I went to somewhere like the Upright Citizens Brigade, that's kind of... that's obviously a lot more laid back. And then...
Yeah. And it's more...
I think it's more a representation of the sort of clubs that you get in England.
Right. Mm. That's good, because I like that more. I haven't performed in England for maybe 10 years. 11 years. And then I did bar shows. I don't even remember where I went up.
Okay.
But in a way, they're the best shows.
It was fun. I had fun. I just was also drunk a lot. So don't quite remember as much.
Sure.
And you've just been... You're currently on the Samat the Bee show.
Yep. I am a co-head writer, co-executive producer.
And so you are... And you have been there in the period you've just had in the States, which has been an interesting period of time in the world, especially in the States, I'd imagine. How was that for you? So have you managed to document the entire Trump era of presidency?
Well, I've only been with this show since 2018, so I don't have the entire Trump era. But yeah, we worked remotely all the way through it. You know, we had one week of the show where they were like, hey, we can't have an audience, and we shot in the studio. And then for 6 months, we had to shoot from Sam's actual house. You know, like, she was shooting from her backyard. But no, we worked remote. We're still working remote. We'll probably work remote until the end of the summer. So I've kind of just been in this bunker with a ton of, you know, toys and video games writing for the show. That said, it's very lucky, since a lot of my friends in TV lost their jobs. Being in New York was scary at first just because it was insane here. But I think because it was insane here first, we're now the best at it not being insane in America.
You mean because everyone got it at once?
Yeah, everyone got it at once. And we were like, oh, we can't do it like this. And then we got our like shit together. But other states were like, oh, we're fine. And now they're like Texas and California are being hit hard.
So what has it been like? I'm sure you'd rather not have Trump. But was in a way a gift to be writing in that era, was it?
I would say it was a minor silver lining that I was able to get like work and write about it. But I think the overall dark cloud was much worse than it. So it's hard for me to be like, it's a blessing, because it wasn't for anybody. But, you know, I got to work, which is always good. But I would have preferred to have had more trouble finding work than him be president.
Yeah,
sure. But I have noticed a thing by watching late night. So I watch Seth Meyers and Jimmy Fallon and Jimmy Kimmel. And it's kind of, I sort of watched them in that order. Mm-hmm. And it was almost like overnight, all the Trump stuff was happening, and it was kind of like riveting to watch to watch the monologues.
Yeah.
And then overnight it was kind of like, oh, Biden's a bit old, isn't he? And then it's
kind of like,
and you go, oh, because there was, although, you know, you could tell as well that all three of those guys, they were so angry.
Right.
You know, especially as like Trump had been guests on some of their shows in the build up to it. But it's sort of like, they're so angry. And then it must be sort of like, you know, the first few shows of like, maybe Jimmy Kimmel was like saying, it's so great not to hear his voice every day. And then it's kind of like, after about a week of that, it's kind of like, yeah, but it was also really handy, wasn't it? Because it was
a constant topical material.
It was, you're right. But I would also say that it's now forcing us to write better jokes because we've had the crutch of Trump for so long. So it might be more challenging, but at least out of that challenge will become something fucking original.
Yeah. Because you have, you know, you have this idea of there are certain things like over here, if you're watching a topical satirical show, they will be doing stuff about Boris Johnson. And there are certain things about Boris Johnson. He's got his hair. He's got... No one seems to know how many kids he's got. So you've like, he doesn't see his kids. Does he have, how many does he have? No one. He's got, so you have these little jokes that are almost like half jokes already. So whatever's happening, you can kind of revert back to the fact that,
yeah,
he doesn't know how many kids he's got. Or there's always like these different punchlines. And then when you've got a whole new guy comes in, suddenly you've got to throw out all these kind of, I guess what they are, they're kind of easy go-tos, aren't they?
Yeah, they're easy go-tos. Or like, he's such a familiar villain that the audience is going to applaud for you whether you're funny or not.
Yeah.
You know, which, you know, we call clapter, which is like, you know, when you say a line and everyone's like, yes, yes. And you're like, I didn't say anything funny though.
Sure. And also, once you've taken away the fact that you've got these people that are angry about what they're saying, it's kind of like, you, in a way, you don't actually need to be funny at all as long as you make a point.
Yes, yeah. But, you know, I got into this to be funny, so I'm, you know... I mean, I like making a point. I like writing topical jokes. I'm, you know, it's most of my career, but I want it to be funny. I want to be a comedy writer who maybe makes a difference or makes people feel better, but comedy's first for me.
Mm-hmm. And I know you're not a political analyst, but do you think he's someone who we'll see again in politics in the forefront?
I think we'll see him again. I don't think he's going to... maybe he will. I don't know if he'll run again. I think he's going to use the specter of him running to scare people into doing what he wants. But I think he's kind of a coward. So I think the fact that he was beat makes him reluctant to try again. You know, he's like one of those people who's like, I'd fight you again, but, you know, I can't right now. And it's like, no, you lost the bar fight. You're not going to fight anyone again. And so that's how I feel about him. But I mean, you know, in America, we also love Boris Johnson because he's easy to make fun of for us. Like, whenever there's like a prime minister who's fucking a cartoon character, that's such a blessing because it gives us so much more. Although you don't know how hard on multiple shows I've tried to get Parliament insult things onto the show, and American audiences aren't with it.
No, no.
I am obsessed with the Parliament insults.
But it is, but I find that element of it so childish as well.
It also doesn't affect me.
It's a school together. So they are reenacting these little kind of petty feuds that they had when they all went to the same school.
And it's
when they all fucked the same pig. It's like... but British politics got so depressing and scary that... I was just I solely focused on Donald Trump for the first half of last year, and that made me feel a lot better. It didn't. I had a nervous breakdown. But,
I remember when Brexit happened. Me and the woman I was living with at the time, we were like, "Well, at least that can't happen here." And then immediately Trump was elected.
Oh God, it was like one thing after another. So, have you ever played Alien Isolation?
I have.
That's scary, isn't it?
It is very scary. And it's well done. It, like, they really recreated the look of the Alien films.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Are you looking at a list of horror games to ask me about?
I bought
it started with A.
I bought an Xbox because I love the Alien films. But Alien I bought Alien Isolation, and I was living on my own in a flat or an apartment. It was a flat with a downstairs basement area, and it was kind of creepy. And I played maybe the first 10 minutes of... I didn't play the first 10 minutes. I played it for 10 minutes, and it was too scary. And that was 3 years ago, and I've never played it again. but I do like Monkey Island, so, you know... It's
Alien Isolation's a lot like Monkey Island, just different.
So, so in terms of like horror games, is that sort of like what Silent Hill is like then?
Silent Hill is a little less, there's not many jump scares in it. It's a little more creepy and sad. So, you know, something like, did you see something like, it's not the same as Midsommar, but it's like a slow burn horror film. It's not like things are jumping out at you and you're like, ah, it's not like Paranormal Activity. It's more like the more you learn, the sadder you get and the darker it gets.
Like, Don't Look Now.
Yeah, like, yeah, exactly. Something that's a little more slow burn, which is also what I like about it, is it's not just like a thing jumping out of a window. It's kind of like, oh, what's going on here?
And I guess that's, correct me if I'm wrong, that's what makes it kind of unique and unusual and different from the first one.
Yes, exactly. The first one had a great story, but it was still a little more action-based, and this is much more like exploration story.
And does it feel like this is a thing where you've written this book where you're trying to convince people and going, no, really? Go back to Silent Hill. Or is it a thing where if you're a gamer, everyone's like, for sure, Silent Hill 2?
I think more the latter. I think it's more like me being like, here's how much I love this game, and I have the opportunity to write about it.
I do find it really interesting that Nathaniel is finding this concept so difficult to grasp when that's what this show is, Nat.
I know. Well, I would say this show, this is probably unrepresentative because this show is usually the nerdiest show, except right. What we hit upon is a subject that neither me and Nick knows a lot about because
right.
I've not really played a lot of computers. So it feels like, I now feel like I am the most mainstream kind of... what even is that? What is a game? I think I completely understand and I really know, and I know from other people that video games have moved on a long way since GoldenEye.
People say,
hey, I was playing The Last of Us 2, and I cried. And I go, in my brain goes... I don't want to cry if I'm playing a computer game. I don't want to cry.
Last time I played a computer game was when my friend beat me at Dr. Mario. They got a really high score. But your whole way of approaching this, Nat, has been, you're a comedian and you've written seriously about a thing that you like. And that's what we had meant to do on the show.
This is exactly what we do on this thing. It feels it's a really odd interview for that reason.
Right, yeah.
Because of you, Nat. you're doing it, and you're continually doing it. What we ask every week, but we never, ever get round to it, is we ask our guests to talk about some of the things that they are big fans of, right?
Yes.
The song that we played for you, we played Amish Paradise by Weird Al Yankovic. What is it about Amish Paradise or Weird Al that you specifically like?
It's a song that reminds me of a very specific time in my life when, you know, like, and the thing is, it's a comedy song, it's a parody of another song, it's a silly song, but because I was like a lonely nerdy kid who liked comedy, you know, I liked things like Nirvana. I liked regular music, but that song was like a song that felt like it was written for me in the sense that like, here's a song that's only purpose is to be goofy and funny. And that struck me in a weird way. Cause it's sort of like, it was also the first album I ever bought with my own money. It just sort of felt like the moment it wasn't the moment I decided to do comedy, but I was like, oh, it's comedy, something I really, really like. And so that song's always felt weirdly important.
Comedy's like that. So what I would say is I get very emotional when I think about Leslie Nielsen.
Yeah.
Because I think he's one of the greatest performers, if not one of the greatest actors that ever lived. When you look at Airplane and Naked Gun, and Weird Al is in the Naked Gun films. But when you look at those, and it hits me, and I think that a lot of the time there's sort of like a debate over what's better, Airplane, Naked Gun, and I'm just like, Naked Gun is just a good film. Like, it's a classic all-time film. It's a good film. It tells a story. There's characters in it that you love. They're a joke. It's silly, but it's a well-made, good film that is almost watertight, and it's got a plot, and it's got its own thing. And so when people kind of... I feel like that is the sort of film that was made specifically for me. And with Weird Al, it's, well, I completely understand that, where, especially back then. So what year was that? That was like late 90s?
Yeah, I think I want to say 96-ish, but I could be off on the date. I don't have it.
It's very hot off the back of Gangster's Paradise.
Yes.
There was, because there wasn't social. So the stuff that I'm still passionate about in my life is the stuff that I discovered almost by accident, off of no recommendations from other people.
Yeah.
So stuff like Tommy Boy. I went to see Tommy Boy because Babe was full, and Chris Farley wasn't a thing over here.
Yeah.
So I went to see Tommy Boy, and I've loved that film ever since. Or Alice Cooper, or Army of Darkness. These are films and music that I discovered from going into a record shop or a video shop and taking a chance on stuff. And it wasn't the internet, and there wasn't social media, and I was a lonely child. And so to find these things that you grew up with, they're really important, I think. So is that what
absolutely
you're saying?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. I think we absolutely agree. And no, I feel the same way. Like Naked Gun and Airplane are good movies, and people are like, they're stupid, and you're like, yeah, that's what they did with the movie. They succeeded in making a good stupid movie.
Whereas you can watch other films that are actually just stupid,
right?
And you go, you know, We talk, I don't want to get you in trouble with anyone that you know, but like stuff like Master of Disguise starring Dana Carvey.
Right, yeah.
One of the worst films ever made. And you go, well, that's a stupid film. And you go, but and even Airplane is based on Zero Hour.
Yeah.
Naked Gun feels like they actually came up with a plot from scratch with this one, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, but with Weird Al, I mean, he did the opening credits to Spy Hard.
Mm-hmm.
He did like cameo appearances in all the Naked Guns. He also did his own film UHF. Did you ever?
Which I love. UHF. I weirdly, whenever I get a new job in TV, I listen to the song UHF on the first day.
Right, because UHF sort of did for cable TV what he did for popular music, wasn't it?
Yeah. Exactly.
I think that's what makes him unusual, because he's someone who certainly, like parody records, they're certainly big over here and have been forever, but right. It almost feels like a radio thing, almost like a comedy radio thing. But what Weird Al does, he puts those on kind of pop radio.
Yeah,
I remember
yeah.
growing up and having like Eat It. It would be played on like pop radio.
Yeah.
Not it's not sort of it's like a hit record. It sells as a single. It's not something you get as part of a sketch show. Or
right.
part of a sort of radio comedy bit. It's he releases them as proper, they're like proper pop radio. I mean, mm-hmm. it's like novelty records, sure, but it's almost that he's doing something different. He's playing to the kind of pop crowd as well.
Yeah.
He's not exactly like, in that way, he's totally a comedian, of course, he's totally a comic, except right. it feels like he's also playing to people that buy pop music, you know?
Yeah. I've seen him play live, and him and his band are good musicians. You know, they're not just like, you know, playing like a simple beat and singing a parody. It's like they're playing music well. So I think that's part of it, too. I think that he's like, he's not just funny, but he's actually good at making the music sound good. So you want to listen to it again. It's not just like, oh, that was funny, and then you're done.
And there's also a certain skill of it, which when he's doing his albums, it's like finding which songs have actually hit the zeitgeist. It's not like mm-hmm. Just taking generic songs and kind of doing covers of them. It's like finding which ones, the Star Wars song that he did. Bye Bye Miss American Pie.
Yep, The Saga Begins, it was called.
And it's kind of like it's taking... who's big in music and what's big in popular culture and sort of combining it and making this thing, you know. I don't really like, because I'm a musician as well, and I steer clear of kind of parody songs, and it's not really my thing. But with Weird Al, kind of, you make an exception because he does it so well.
Right, yeah.
I would also imagine that a Weird Al show is probably better than most shows you'd see, because it's definitely the kind of show that everyone there will be
absolutely
incredibly excited to be there. You're not going to be casual Weird Al fans, I imagine.
No, like, that's exactly right. He's also, like, he's the one, he's, I don't get starstruck, but he's, like, the one celebrity I've ever met that I was like, you're Weird Al. And he was like, yeah. And I met him when I was working at Fallon. So I was there for a reason. I wasn't scaring him like I was supposed to be there. And I just didn't know what to say to him. It was the most nervous I've been.
And one of your other choices was a choice of film is the film The Thing.
Yeah!
Hunter film, The Thing. And me and Nick talk about The Thing every week.
Yeah.
Comes up. And this is our opportunity this week to talk about The Thing with someone who isn't either Nick or I.
I've got three The Thing posters.
Wow. The unpublished novella that they changed into Who Goes There?
Right.
Wait, I also have a board game, which I won't ruin the audio grabbing.
Sure. So we saw that your thing was one of the thing was one of the choices. We mention it by accident every single week for the last 2 years.
We try not to talk about it.
We didn't even realize how often we mentioned it until listeners started writing in saying, "Are you going to talk about The Thing again?" And we were like, "What? We don't talk about The Thing, do we? We talk about it every week, but we haven't talked about it yet because we knew you were going to. It was one of your choices." So what is it about The Thing that you like? Okay, so The Thing is, it's one of the best films ever made.
I agree with you. I wholeheartedly agree. I think because it's such a contained movie. It's like, you know, it's nobody gets in, nobody gets out, which is always such a great story. And it's so many good, it's well-paced. There's so many good actors in it. You don't know what's going to happen. The practical effects still hold up perfectly. Like, everything about it is enjoyable to watch every time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I know you guys agree.
What he said, guys. One of the things, one of my favorite things about it is that Ennio Morricone does the score for it. And when Ennio Morricone was asked to do the score, he was in such disbelief that John Carpenter wasn't doing the score himself. He said, "Hey, why aren't you doing the score?" And John Carpenter said, "Oh, they won't let me." And so Ennio Morricone said, "I'll do it like John Carpenter tribute." And so everyone thinks that John Carpenter did the score for The Thing because Ennio Morricone, who's this incredible musician, deliberately did sort of like a John Carpenter parody just to sort of like make it fit with all of his other films. I think that's great.
That's awesome. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, it's brilliant. And so it's really weird because The Thing, because John Carpenter's obviously, we went to see John Carpenter a couple of years ago, didn't we? So that Thing soundtrack just fits right in with all of his other
But I like that he plays it. He plays The Thing soundtrack at his own gigs. He does like, I'll do a cover now.
It's the thing. You guys might know this one. It's The Thing.
And also, it's kind of... I love the fact that Kurt Russell and John Carpenter made all these films together, and they were kind of like... So I've got a picture of Kurt Russell and John Carpenter on the set of Big Trouble in Little China. And they've got their arms folded together and they stood next to each other and they've posed. And it's on my girlfriend's side of the bed. I love them so much. Every time I roll over in bed in the morning to look at her, I've got John Carpenter and Kurt Russell over her shoulder. They were a great like partnership, I think. And I think The Thing, Big Trouble in Little China is one of the funniest films mm-hmm. I think ever made. But I never really got on board with Escape from New York.
Yeah.
And The Thing is kind of like, this is what happens when they do serious, sort of gritty, bleak science fiction.
Yeah.
Something else I noticed when I was doing my little bit of research on you, Mike, was I went, it's written for Marvel Comics. I went, what's that? And then, of course, I looked up to see what it was. And I went, I've got that. And it is the...
Yeah!
Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man Annual number one.
Which my name might be misspelled on. That might be the... I still have one where my name is spelled without the C.
Yeah, this is it. Drucker.
Drucker. It's spelled right inside the comic, but on the outside, which is great when it's like your first comic with your name on it. Great that it's misspelled.
How did that come about?
It's just a mistake. Like, they just made a mistake because it's spelled right inside.
Their whole job.
The guy's keyboard wasn't working.
Like, I don't know.
Something, he was doing something else the same time.
I took you so literally. I was like, I don't know. The copy editor wasn't in.
Imagine if that's all we wanted to ask you about. It says here you wrote for Spider-Man, but they got your name wrong.
It says Drucker. All right. Thanks very much. Thanks for coming on. See you later.
For a couple award shows I'm friends with Patton Oswalt, and I've written for a couple award shows that he's hosted, and another writer on it's this guy Jerry Duggan, who writes a lot of things for Marvel, and they were looking for someone to fill in a couple like short comics, and Jerry recommended me, and they were nice enough to take me.
And so, do you come from the perspective of being a comic book fan? Is that your inroad to it?
Yeah, I have not kept up as well as I used to. Like in college, and right after college, I was very good at it, and then I fell off. But yeah, no, it's coming from the place of a fan.
I was impressed as well that for someone who it's their first job at Marvel, that it's drawn by Chris Bacallo.
I know.
That's a big deal, Nick, because he's one of the big. He's like, you've got a big guy to do your first Marvel comic.
Yeah. Yeah, when they told me it was him, I was like, I don't think that's not the name I think it is. Like, I had to re-Google him just because I was like, I think that's a famous artist.
So, do you know that he's drawing going in, or is that something that happens once you've delivered your script?
I'm sure if you're more established, that's a little more like this guy's partnering with you. I turned in my script, and then they told me who the artist was.
Nat used to work in a comic book shop, and I grew up watching comics, but I was addicted to comics, and they kept putting stuff aside for me that I hadn't agreed to, and then I couldn't afford it. And eventually, it was like being bullied by the mafia, and I had to go cold turkey and just never... I was 16, and I was confused and scared, and I had to never go into a comic book shop ever again. So I got up to about Spawn issue 126, and then I don't know what happened after that. I imagine Todd McFarlane tried to sell more toys, but that's all I know, right?
Yeah.
So when it comes to writing a script for a comic book,
yeah,
how do you go about doing that?
Do you mean like the actual technical way, or like how do I make sure something's not like breaking canon or something?
Well, do the technical stuff first.
Technical stuff, it's pretty loose. I basically asked Jerry Duggan for one of his scripts and kind of followed the format of it. But really, it's almost like you're describing a drawing, you're describing the text in it, you're describing a drawing. But like at the top of the page, you're like broken up into six panels or like two big panels or one full page or whatever. And you describe it. And yeah, you do the word bubbles, the thought bubbles, what have you. You have to be in as detailed as possible. Like you can't just be like Spider-Man swings. Otherwise, the artist will come and be like, hey, what do you mean?
So you've got to take the interpretation out of it.
Yes, you really do. Like, so, and the artist will come back to you at times and be like, hey, I know you said this, but is there a way we could do this? Or like, you know, I wrote like a short Deadpool comic once, and the artist was like, I know what you're trying to write, but the character is not the same size as the thing that you think it is. And I was like, okay, so we'll change it to this. So it is collaborative. It's not just like, here's what you draw and they go away. There's also like those words won't fit. Is there a different way to do this? Or do you want to break these panels up? But it's really just description, dialogue, description, dialogue, but as description heavy as you can be.
And then in terms of like not breaking canon, how, I guess, would if you were coming on to do a short run or a comic here and there, it would be to make the story as self-contained as possible, right?
Yeah, they're pretty good about... at least the editor I worked with was pretty good about giving me feedback and kind of like, hey, this character, like I had in the Spider-Man comic, I had them beating up a different villain. I forget who. There's a scene where a bunch of kids are beating up like a D-list villain. And I had it as a different villain. And it was someone else before. I think maybe the Shocker before that. It was someone that they were like, actually, this guy's doing something now. You know, so like they'll sort of catch you and stuff, and you're giving them a plot outline before you write the script. Like I gave them sort of like a beat by beat what I was thinking kind of description, because it was a shorter comic. So there too, they could have been like, hey, don't do this, or Spider-Man isn't here right now, or that. They're good at catching you. They do encourage you, obviously, to keep up.
Yeah. I never noticed that, because you've even got mentions of like characters like Jean de Wolf, and you think, yeah. Oh, this feels a bit inside baseball. It doesn't feel very, someone's come in and they've been hired from something else.
Yeah, no.
Quite obscure characters and things, you go, oh. Which is often like, often that always feels like it's talking to the audience a bit. It's a bit like, yeah. I know, don't worry about it.
There's definitely an element of that too, of trying to prove myself.
Yeah. I'll just throw a couple of names just to, just to let them know who I am, what I'm dealing with.
I mean, kind of, yeah. You're not wrong.
But of course, I understand. Of course, that's what you do. Oh, it looks like we're quite near the end of our show, or near our chat.
Ah.
Okay. Well, we've got a game to play with you, Mike. But before we play the game, have you got any last thoughts on anything that you've said over the last 15 minutes?
I think The Thing is a great movie. You guys should bring it up as much as you want on the show. It's your show.
Thank you.
So I say keep talking about The Thing. And buy my book, Silent Hill 2 from Boss Fight Books.
Okay. Fine. That's good. We might use that as a sound bite. So get people off our backs. It's a bit about The Thing, not the bit about your book.
It's out now. Available.
It's out now. Thank you.
I've done a terrible job at promoting Silent Hill 2. I do imagine that the people that would listen to this show have probably already got it. They're already dialing it up and they're incredibly excited.
If you can't, for the listeners at home, if you don't know what Silent Hill is, it's very much like Monkey Island meets Alien Isolation. So I'm going to hand you, Mike, I'm going to hand you over to Nathaniel now, who's going to take over, and we're going to play the world-famous game, the internationally famous game, especially in Malta, where we are 117th on the chart. 117 in Malta? We've gone down so far, Nat.
I think we're 43.
We were 43 last week. What the fuck's gone on? I haven't sworn this week. That's the first time I've sworn. Oh, wow. What a cunt. So let's. So without further ado, let's play the game Better or Worse.
Okay, Mike, this is the game Better or Worse, and you have to say whether the next person on the list is better or worse than the person before, based entirely on my opinions to score points.
Great.
Starting with Bill Murray. Is Billy Dee Williams better or worse than Bill Murray?
Oh, that's a tough question. That's a tough, complicated question. I'm going to say I'm going to say Bill Murray, but it's hard. I'm going to say Bill Murray, but it's hard.
Correct. Okay. Is Billy Bob Thornton better or worse than Billy Dee Williams?
A couple years ago, I would have said better, but now I'm going to say worse. I'm going to say Billy Bob Thornton's worse.
Billy Crystal, better or worse than Billy Bob Thornton?
Better.
You know what? I find Billy Crystal annoying, but I think as a quality overall, I'm going to say better.
Better. And it's also my opinion.
Yeah.
He is better.
Billy I think Zane, he's a good comedian. I just find him annoying.
It's all right. You can say that you hate him. It's fine. we'll use that as the clip that goes out.
Oh, no! I'll never write for the 1993 Oscars.
Billy Zane, better or worse than Billy Crystal?
Worse.
Billy Connolly, better or worse than Billy Zane?
Better, yeah.
Billy Piper, better or worse than Billy Connolly?
I don't know who Billy Piper is.
Worse.
Fair enough.
Worse.
Billy Holiday, better or worse than Billy Piper?
Better. I'm going to say better.
Better. Billy Joel, better or worse than Billy Holiday?
Better.
I'm going to say worse. I'm going to say worse.
Billy Idol, better or worse than Billy Joel?
Better.
That's a tough one because both are so. You know what? I enjoy Billy Idol more. I'm going to say better.
Better.
Billy Joel, I think, might be technically better, but in terms of my enjoyment, I'm going to go Idol.
Don't overthink it, Mike.
I can't help it.
Billie Eilish.
Can't help it.
Billy Idol.
Who's better or worse?
Billie Eilish. Better or worse than Billy Idol?
I think she's really good.
I'm going to say better.
Worse, but only because I don't really know who she is.
Fair. fair.
I've heard the name.
Nine! Right. Okay. Mike Drucker, you've scored nine. That's if we're counting Billy Piper, which I think we are, which is a great score, which means that you're not as good as Jen Brister, Thomas Coombs, Jason Manford, Joe Scaldoni with 10, but you are as good as David Baddiel, Ken Cheng, Harry Hill and Luke Morley with 9, and you're better than Matt Crosby, Susie Dent, Charles Eston, Eddie Hearn, David Hepworth, Jason Isaacs and Simon West, John Niven, Magical Bone, Samantha Morton, Matt O'Cohen, Miranda Raisin, Griff Rhys-Jones, Chris Stark, Stu Whiffen with 8, Richard Owen, James King, Ludi Lynn, Henry Normal, Janet Varney, Johnny Vegas with 7, Gary Delaney, now Frizzell, Frank Harper with 6, and poor old Dave McLean with 5. So, you scored a very high and respectable 9.
Yeah.
Well done. Thank you so much for being a guest on our show. It was lovely talking to you. Don't go anywhere. We need a photo. it's goodbye from me. It's goodbye from Nat. Welcome to the clubhouse, Mike. And for all of our listeners, thank you for tuning in. Look after yourselves. Wear a mask. Wash your hands. I've been Seth Meyer. We love you. Goodbye.